Hello, friends, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Rita Peters, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Dean Welty. We've got a great program planned for you today, and we are so glad you have joined us for it again. One quick thing that we want to make you aware of is that this program is a rebroadcast discussing my book, Restoring America's Soul. Now, I wrote the book when I was still Rita Dunaway, but don't let that throw you. It's still me, and I hope you enjoy the program.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway, and this is part four in our review of Rita's new book entitled Restoring America's Soul. Now, if you're new to the program, and as a reminder for the rest of us, I need to give a little background on Rita so that we know what, quote, qualifies her for this challenging task of restoring America's soul. That's a big subject. Well, Rita is a constitutional attorney with honors degrees from West Virginia University and the Washington and Lee University School of Law. She has worked as staff counsel for the Rutherford Institute, as an allied attorney for the nationally respected Alliance Defending Freedom, and is now serving as the national legislative strategist for the Convention of States Project. She is also a nationally syndicated columnist who's been published in numerous media outlets, in addition to her column for the Daily News Record here in Harrisonburg, and most importantly, as co-host of our Crossroads programs. Finally, above all else, and in her own words, she is committed to her young family as a wife and a mother. All that to say, Rita, that we are very glad to have you with us again today and every week.
Aw, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, let's get started. We have a lot of ground to cover, so by way of review for those who may have missed any of our earlier programs, we began by talking about the importance of telling people what we as conservatives are for rather than just what we are against. Then we went on to address the importance of tone in our conversations and in our debates, particularly when we get into hot-button issues of politics, religion, and morality. Rita, you also emphasized the need to listen if we expect people to listen to us. And finally, last week, we talked about the importance of making decisions on the basis of what we know to be true and good rather than on our feelings, which are so often influenced by phrases like, follow your dreams, listen to your heart, and if it feels good, do it. Well, so today, Rita, that brings us to chapter four, which is entitled Rooted in Conservative Principles. And I expect that when some folks hear the title of your book, again, with the word soul in it, they might not like the suggestion that our whole government is founded not only on the principles of conservatism, but, oh no, also on biblical teaching and principles. So how do you answer to that?
Well, Dean, I realize it's going to be a tough pill for some out there to swallow, yeah. But that's just the way it is. It's a matter of our heritage and our history. And I'm not sure there's anything else to say about that. History is what it is. There was a strong Judeo-Christian ethic in our founding generation. So whether people like that or not, they shouldn't be surprised that it is really the worldview that undergirds the whole structure of our government.
Well, Rita, in the world we live in today, there are some people who'd say, well, that's just your opinion.
Uh-huh, right. That's your truth.
That's your truth.
Well, it's the truth.
But you're exactly right. That is the truth. And I have to wonder how anyone can see it any differently if they've studied it at all. But just in case some may still have doubts about any of this, let's look at the evidence. And I think one of the best proofs of this centrality of the Bible in the formation of America is from a study done by two political science professors who conducted a massive review of the political content in some 15,000 documents that were written during America's founding period between 1760 and 1805. And I wonder if our listeners would speculate in their minds, what was the single most important source in all of these documents? What they discovered was amazing. Get ready?
I'm ready.
The one source that was cited or quoted most often by our founding fathers in these political writings was the Bible.
Wow.
At 34%. That was more than the next three sources combined. Ones from Montesquieu, Blackstone, and John Locke.
Wow, that is amazing. The Bible.
It blows you away.
Huh. I mean,
it really does.
And their political writings.
These are any political comments made in these 15,000 documents.
Oh, that's amazing.
Well, even those three, that is the three following ones, they were also professing Christians whose views were influenced directly and positively by the Bible.
You're talking about Montesquieu, Blackstone, and Locke.
That's exactly
okay.
Right.
Okay, so even their secondary sources were also Christian.
You put those together, it's over 50%.
Amazing.
Now let's turn to education. The primary textbooks for the colonists at large and also for our founding fathers were the Bible and the New England Primer. The New England Primer was just a little book that they could put in their saddlebags or in their backpacks. They didn't have to carry so much to school. But that itself included many biblical passages and church creeds, such as the Shorter Catechism, with its 107 questions and answers from the Bible that the students were required to memorize.
Wow.
A good example is the first question. What is the first end of man? The answer? To glorify God and enjoy Him forever. 107 of those questions and answers that the students were required to memorize. And then there was also the Blueback Speller and the early McGuffey Readers, both of which also included numerous biblical references and moral teachings. So, Rita, the question is not whether the Bible was a central part of their lives, but rather, how did the Bible shape their characters and ultimately their view of government? Well, Rita, I hope that's enough proof for most of us.
Yeah, it's amazing to reflect on that, how the Bible, the scriptures, were the stuff of their education. That was the content of their education.
Well, in fact, Time magazine, I think it was in the mid-1980s, dedicated a whole issue to the Bible as the source of our government.
Hmm.
Well, Rita, you also talk about the fact that the founders demonstrated a commitment to the moral law as another form of evidence that they aligned with the principles of conservatism that we've been talking about. But can you flesh that out a little bit for us?
Well, you know, while I talk about it in the book in terms of their commitment to this concept of the universal moral law more broadly, the fact is, and it's evidenced by the studies you just cited, the fact is the founders overwhelmingly believed specifically in the God of the Bible and the moral laws expressed in the Bible. But see, when you really think about it, the moral laws we read about in the Bible are really aligned with the moral laws that are, we would say, universal, because they're ingrained in the souls of every person the world over, no matter what their cultural heritage or where they come from. So that's why I talk about it more broadly.
You know, Rita, that's such an interesting comment, because those laws are ingrained in our souls, but we also know that we are inherently depraved.
Yes.
So we've got these dueling influences in our hearts. But Rita, you go on to point out that not only was this commitment to the moral law central to the system devised by the founders, but just as central was their awareness that mankind is inherently apt to stray from that moral law.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Of course, the Bible teaches that every human being is inherently sinful. None of us is perfect. And that's why we needed Christ to come and die on the cross, so that if we put our trust in Him, we can be made right with God and have peace with Him. And the founders knew this, which was why they very thoughtfully designed a system of government that separated powers and included many forms of restraints and checks and balances. James Madison famously said in Federalist 51, and I quote, "In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this: you must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself, end quote. So there is a great strong piece of evidence that the founders knew that it is the inherent tendency of man to want to assume more and more power for himself and to use it in ways that don't necessarily benefit everyone.
I just have to smile at this because our government today has certainly enabled itself to control the governed.
Yes.
But I'm not so sure about its ability
to control itself.
Yeah,
we have a problem with the other part.
Well, Rita, you also point out in your book that the founders sought to design a national government that would do only what the people really needed government to do, and to otherwise leave the people free to pursue virtue through liberty rather than through government coercion. And again, a lesson we can take to heart today. But share with us, Rita, some of the major proofs you cite for this and for the idea that our whole government structure is premised on truth, on the moral law, and a particular understanding of mankind.
Okay, well, I'm going to give some examples chronologically from, you know, before the founding of our government and our Constitution and moving forward through time. So let's start with Thomas Paine, who was the author of the Common Sense pamphlet that encouraged the colonies to seek independence from Great Britain. He talks about the propensity for government to, quote, invade the prerogative of heaven, end quote. So that shows us this conviction that the proper role of government is a limited one, and government is not to interfere with what is left to God and to heaven. I find that so interesting. Wow. Especially when you look at our government situation today.
Everything you're saying just pops out at me. Yeah. Go ahead.
The tendency today is for so many Americans to look to government. Government has become this sort of idol. And I think that's exactly what Thomas Paine was speaking against.
Well, I was going to say that sounds so familiar to our time because it seems like many of us today also think that we know more than God and want to sit on the throne of heaven in his place. But let's expand on that just a little more. For example, I noticed that Thomas Paine wrote his Common Sense just months before the Declaration of Independence, which lists 27 trials and usurpations that King George had inflicted on the American colonies, and they considered all of them to be an unacceptable invasion of their freedoms.
That's right. And the Declaration of Independence, authored primarily by Virginia's own Thomas Jefferson, contains a direct appeal to the laws of nature and of nature's God. That clearly demonstrates their conviction that there is a law that is higher than the laws of man. And it casts this vision for a government that would be consistent with that law.
Well, Rita, that is so powerful. That reference to the laws of nature's God is a direct reference to the laws from the Bible, which we consider to be the Word of God. So what King George is doing to them at that time was considered to be a violation of God's law, and therefore, that gave them the right to declare their independence.
Absolutely. Now, fast forward a little bit to the Constitutional Convention. When Benjamin Franklin stopped the whole meeting, when things didn't seem to be moving forward in a positive direction, and he said this, and I quote, "In this situation of this assembly, groping as it were in the dark to find political truth, and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of lights to illuminate our understanding?" And he continued, "I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, Is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? End quote. I love that, Dean. It's beautiful and so clearly points to this conviction that God governs and is sovereign in the affairs of men and nations.
Well, I love that quotation too, Rita. And it's interesting that Ben Franklin is also referred to as a deist. That is someone who doesn't believe that God is involved in our lives today. They question whether he's active and sovereign. But clearly, by the passage that you just cited, Franklin believed strongly that God is very much active and governs in the affairs of men, as did nearly all of the other founding fathers who were in the room when he said that.
Yeah. Well, now let's move forward to George Washington, our first president. And I want to give you a quote from him in his inaugural address to Congress in 1789. Here starts the quote. "We ought to be no less persuaded that the propitious smiles of heaven can never be expected on a nation that disregards the eternal rules of order and right which heaven itself has ordained," end quote. So again, we see that absolute conviction that there is a universal moral law, he calls them the eternal rules of order, that are ordained by heaven.
Well, Rita, that's another great quote. And these examples certainly demonstrate their belief in God and in a higher moral law. But sadly, as we discussed last week, most of our society today seems to have rejected the idea of absolute truth and a universal moral law. And as we mentioned earlier in our introduction, they think that everyone has his or her own truth and that we should just follow our hearts or do what feels good. What a stark contrast that is to what our founders believed.
Exactly. And so you can see that some Americans have really bought into a worldview that is inconsistent with the way our government was designed to operate.
That's right. And I think there's something else at work in our culture, and it's the lack of a strong education about these underpinnings of our government. I certainly didn't learn about it when I was in school. Not until the last couple of years I wanted to know about our heritage, and it all came through. But there's simply no comparison with how our children today are educated in many of our public schools with how our early settlers and founding fathers were educated, or even how our own parents were educated, as we mentioned earlier. And I think one of the major causes of our moral and spiritual decline in America today was the Supreme Court's decision in the early 60s to ban school-sponsored prayer and Bible reading from our public schools. That decision left a moral and spiritual vacuum in our students, especially those who were unchurched. And it explains much of the confusion and coarsening in our culture today. And as a result, a growing number of parents have felt the need to either teach their children at home or send them to a private and mainly Christian school.
That's right. And as I say in the book, Dean, I think that one of the most damaging voids in the education of the younger generations is an understanding of what the purpose of government is. In other words, I think that understanding is lacking. But it's really one of the most basic questions. Dean, do you think that most young people today would have a good answer for the question, what is the purpose of government?
Well, I'm about 60 years past what young people might be thinking. But it is an important question, and I can only guess at the answer from what I see and hear in our popular culture. It seems to me that not only many of our young people, but also many adults see the government as a magnified sugar daddy who will supply not only all of their needs, but also their wants. Free education from pre-K on through college, universal health care that includes abortions, carefree and work-free welfare programs, and on and on and on until, as Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher said at one time, until we run out of other people's money. And it reminds me of a town hall that I attended years ago. Then Senator George Allen was the speaker. And when he opened it up for questions, he opened up all their hands, reaching out to him not with questions, but with requests for money to pay for their pet programs. I was stunned then, and even more now, when it seems that people expect the government to pay for everything, and which too many of our national leaders seem all too willing to do in order to get reelected, adding even more to our growing national debt that we transfer over to our children.
Yeah. Well, and the thing we all need to understand is that this question of the purpose or role of government isn't one that is just a matter of opinion where there is no wrong answer. And I say that for two reasons. First of all, as we talked about just a few minutes ago, as a matter of truth and the moral law, there is such a thing as good government and such a thing as bad government. It's not just all relative. But more importantly, if you're an American, our founding documents tell us what the purpose of government is. And so if we reject that, then we're going to be building policy on a foundation that will not support it. And that is exactly what we see happening today that has made our government so dysfunctional.
Well, and Rita, I think when you say that our founding documents tell us the purpose of government, you're referring primarily to the Declaration of Independence, right?
Right.
Well, and specifically where it says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And here's the end of that. "That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." Their purpose is to secure these rights.
Exactly. So to the question, what is the purpose of government? There we can point definitively to an answer. It's to secure the rights of the people to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
And of course, we also see the conviction there that our rights come from God, not from man or from government, because what man gives, man can also take away.
Yeah, and I think the best summary of this concept is from our friend Thomas Paine again. He said, and I quote, "Some writers have so confounded society with government as to leave little or no distinction between them, whereas they are not only different, but have different origins." And he explains that. He says, "Society is produced by our wants and government by our wickedness. The former, society, promotes our happiness positively by uniting our affections. The latter, government, negatively by restraining our vices." And I think that, Dean, is just such a clear explanation of the limited role of government. Government isn't to be out there doing things proactively to try to make our lives better. It's there to protect us. Its power is better seen in sort of a negative or reactive view. It's there to give us justice when injustice is done and to protect our borders. And
yes,
those are the powers of government.
Well, you talk about protecting our borders. I see government as building the guardrails that will protect us from attacks on
yes.
our life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So we've talked about the overwhelming evidence that the founders were believers in absolute truth and the moral law, but how specifically do we see those convictions reflected in the way they structured the mm-hmm. government?
Well, we see it most clearly in the way that government power is both divided and limited. We have the separation of powers, and we have these systems of checks and balances.
Well, when most of us think of government power being divided, we think of the separation of powers among the three branches of the federal government in order to provide a system of checks and balances on each other, the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. But you suggest that there's another way government power is divided that's even more significant.
That's right. And sometimes we in modern America tend to forget this, and I think it's caused us some trouble. But I think the most significant way power is dispersed and divided is between the national or federal government and the states. The founders set up a national government to have powers that are limited and specific, and left the states with power that is much broader and more general. That was meant to be, in and of itself, a control and limitation on federal power.
I agree. That's the best example of the division between the powers that belong to the federal and state governments, but even to the people themselves. There's no doubt about that because it's so clearly stated in the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. So, Rita, the big question in my mind is why, if it's so clear, isn't it working the way our founders intended?
Well, it's not working because those limitations on federal power have been eroded over time. The federal government, as the founders predicted, has reached over past its boundaries. And then, unfortunately, rather than being faithful to come in and check and restrain that power, unfortunately, our courts too often have just colluded with those acts of federal overreach and given them their blessing, which has allowed it to continue. And effectively, it's created loopholes in the Constitution that now need to be repaired. And you know I want to start talking about the Convention of States.
We'll get to that at the end of
okay,
your book.
Okay, okay.
Be patient.
All right.
Well, part of this, too, is the old saying, Rita, the best laid plans of mice and men go oft awry. And we have an example in the Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence, where our founders devised a grand scheme for government. But there were also times when they had to sacrifice the ideal and the perfect for reaching the most good that they could get. And I'll just mention this briefly. We could talk a lot about this, but that is to say, they did not and perhaps could not always live up to their convictions if they were to achieve their highest goal, which was to create a United States of America. And the issue of slavery is a good example of how they had to make some compromises. Because while the Declaration of Independence clearly stated that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that governments were instituted among men to secure these rights, nevertheless, they were unable to ban slavery at that time for purely political and national reasons, because some states would not have joined the Union if they had been forced to free their slaves, and the Union would have been lost. But again, they still had those timeless principles in the Declaration, and so they were right in making that compromise, because in the end, they were later able to correct this injustice through a long and bloody civil war and the process of constitutional amendments. Well, Rita, before we close, I wonder if you could just sum up this part of your book and how folks can get a copy of it.
Well, to sum up really briefly this chapter of the book, it's about the fact that the principles of the Founding Fathers are the principles of conservatism. And the whole structure of our government is founded upon those principles and upon biblical principles. So I think that's important for everyone to understand, especially our young people, in order to grow up with the right concept of the limited role and purpose of government in our society. I'd love for people to get a copy of the book. You can order it on Amazon, and I know it will be coming soon, if it's not already, at Blessings Christian Bookstore, which is one of our program sponsors. We'd love to have you buy it from Blessings Christian Bookstore, which is located at 313 Neff Avenue here in Harrisonburg.
Well, Rita, we've covered a lot of territory today, and I just want to thank you again for walking through now at least these first four chapters of your book with us. And as a reminder, our guest and co-host has been Rita Dunaway, author of a new book entitled Restoring America's Soul. She'll be back with us again next week for part 5 of this series on how to put all these great ideas into practice, beginning with our commitment to care for the poor. And since we'll be refocusing on the remaining chapters of this book for several more weeks, I would again encourage you to get your own copy so you can follow along with us.
Thanks again to our generous sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services, Blessings Christian Bookstore, Sunshine Ministries with Christian Radio, Wishing Well Florists and Travel Services, and our good friends at New Beginnings Church and Garber's Church of the Brethren in Harrisonburg. Thank you all for listening and also for your encouragement and financial support. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can do so by check to Crossroads at P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, 22803. If you would like to listen to this program again or share it with your friends, go to valleyfamilyforum.org. and click on the link to Crossroads on the homepage. I'm Rita Peters with Dean Welty and engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week for another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet.